Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Welcome back to the RTC Weekly Download, if you are coming back. And if you're here for the first time, well, welcome one and all. I think we have a good show today. Today is going to be a grab bag program, and that means that we're going to have some odds and ends from radio's past. Nothing famous, but interesting, because you get to hear what else was on the radio other than the Jack Bennies and the Fred Allens and the Lux Theaters and so forth. Well, today we're going to start off with Fats Waller, the Stride Piano King, and this is from 1938, so this is a 15-minute program. We'll be back after that with Confidentially Yours, Alan Hale, from the 40s. After that, the Ad Club Drama from KFI during the World War II years, and finally, we're going to have a soap opera, This Life Is Mine. We don't have a date on this, but Ellen Felt Sure, that's the title of the show, so I hope you enjoy this selection of odds and ends from radio's past. And if you do, why don't you send us an email at radioent.com and indicate somewhere that this is for the podcast on that email address. So let's get started with Fats Waller.
Contributing to your Saturday evening's entertainment in a most delightful way, the one and only Fat Waller in a program of rhythmic hotshot.
Oh, please, gentlemen, please. My, these announcing fellas really do put on the dog. And just for that, boys, come over here and hold my hand. Am I happy? Tickle pink. There's no telling how I feel. I'm so happy. I keep wondering, is this real? Come on and hold my hand. There's romance in the weather. Hold my hand as lightly as a feather. Hold my hand. Oh, baby, let's get together. You and me, early. Tip, tip, tipping in harmony. Kiss me, dear. It would be one sweet flavor. Lips like yours must have a lovely flavor. Oh, what a sensation. I dig your grin. Come on, baby, hold my hand. Hold it, hold it, hold it. That's a lot of fun, boys. Let's hear. Get this. Come on, Herman. Give me some of that horn there. Are you ready? Uh-oh. No. Give me a little rhythm there, Herman. What? Oh, listen here. Come here. Stop beating around the bush. That ain't the way. Stop beating around that mulberry bush. Mulberry bush. Mulberry bush. Stop beating around the mulberry bush. Come out and say you love me. Stop beating round the mulberry bush, mulberry bush, mulberry bush. Stop beating round the mulberry bush when there's a moon above me. This is the way to win my heart, win my heart, win my heart. You better begin before we part. Blue and broken hearted, stop beating round that mulberry bush, mulberry bush, mulberry bush. Stop beating round the mulberry bush. Come on, say you love me. Send me on out there now.
Think it's worth saying any more than hallelujah. Look out.
Bye.
Yes, yes, and look out. Here we go. This old world's a small place. Someday you're going to run across me and we're going to cross paths. And if we do, well, you'll have the advantage. Because you can tell me you're a little skinny guy with a low-down piano. Mm-hmm. Yes, I get it. So let's make it even.
What's your name?
Don't think me fresh or indiscreet when I say how do you do. I've waited long enough, my sweet, for just 3 words with you. What's your name? I could never guess it. What's your name? Couldn't you confess it? What a shame. We have never met before. Ah, don't you see? Everything's in order. Stick with me. Mama's little daughter, sweet and free. Who could ever ask for more? Where were you all this time? From now on, please be mine. I don't care where you've been. Open your heart and let me in. What's your name? Don't you want to tell it? What's your name? Tell me how to spell it. Now's the time. You should have a name like mine. Baby, please be game and tell me.
Until you see me again. And when you see me again,
the man that sets the joint a-jumpin' in 15 minutes of his famous rhythmic style.
Richfield is on the air. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Arthur Hale, confidentially yours. 15 minutes of news behind the news, gathered by Transradio and presented on behalf of the independent distributors and dealers in Richfield Gasoline and Richlube Motor Oil, those partners in power that keep your motor young. By the way, do you always have good luck when you go fishing? If not, you'll be interested in an announcement later on. Listen for it. Every surface indication tonight points to an almost immediate spread of the war to the Pacific. Confidential advices from the Orient, however, suggest that it will not be surprising if the Japanese suddenly discover that they don't need naval and air bases at the southern tip of French Indochina after all. Fast-moving developments during the past 24 hours have made radical changes in the aspect of the Far Eastern situation, and there has been a sudden lull in the truculent sword rattling heard in Tokyo as late as yesterday. Today, the Konoye government found itself face to face with stern opposition from outside, and what was even more serious for its plans, confronted with an appalling lack of support at home. It must be remembered that to date, there has been no formal or official announcement that Japan was to occupy naval and air bases on southern Indochina. It was officially announced in Hanoi last night that certain demands concerning Indochina had been submitted to the Vichy government. In Vichy, a government spokesman said the French government had agreed, in principle, to the Japanese demands. Sensational reports were circulated of the appearance of a formidable Japanese naval force convoying a fleet of army transports off the Indochina coast. However, it must be remembered that these reports originated in Chinese sources. The Chinese have very good reasons for creating the impression of a serious Japanese threat to British and United States interests. But up until this hour, there are no reports from any source of the landing or the preparation for landing of Japanese troops at Saigon or Kamran Bay. A sudden muting of the Tokyo war drums was noticeable this morning about the time that the Japanese government had finished decoding a cable from its envoy in Washington, Admiral Nomura, reporting on his Wednesday interview with Undersecretary of State Wells. Undersecretary Wells told Admiral Nomura that the United States government would consider Japanese occupation of bases in southern Indochina as a threat to the Philippines and to vital United States supply routes. That was realistic language with a vengeance, rather than the usual, more restrained talk of a policy of not recognizing territory acquired by force or a threat of force. By informing the Japanese that the United States considered a threat to exist, Undersecretary Wells made it unmistakably clear that the Washington government could be expected to do something about it. Meanwhile, in Tokyo, the inspired press opened a feverish campaign to assure the Japanese people that if the United States took economic measures in retaliation for Japan's occupation of Indochina, the measures would prove a boomerang. The newspapers pictured widespread unemployment in the United States if imports of Japanese raw silk were placed under embargo. Naturally, the Tokyo newspapers said nothing concerning the effects on Japan's raw silk industry if its biggest and almost only remaining market should be closed. The Japanese newspapers also renewed their charges that the United States and Britain were conspiring with China and the Soviet Union to encircle Japan. The press campaign obviously was aimed at winning reluctant public support for the government's new aggressive policies. Late reports from neutral observers indicate that the winning of such support is a well-nigh impossible task, and that any move that carries with it a threat of a clash with the United States will be opposed by a large section of the Japanese public. Therefore, these observers reason, Japan may not go through with her program. It was recognized, however, that there was a strong probability that the Konoye regime has been pushed too far by the radical military element in Japan to turn back, and must see the thing through or lose face, both at home and abroad. In addition to the expansionist clique at home, the Tokyo government is under terrific pressure from Berlin to implement its pledges under the three-power pact. With his armies slowing up on the Russian front and the British Air Force pounding at his war industries, Hitler is in desperate need of a diversion to lessen British and American pressure, and the Far East is the logical place for it. The decision is up to Japan, and it's still 50-50 tonight on whether the Nipponese will take the gamble of obeying the orders from Berlin and risking war with the democracies, or back down and abandon the long-held dream of a completely Japanese-dominated Orient. As you've probably heard time and again, carrying coals to Newcastle is a very futile job, but carrying coal to Lewiston, Pennsylvania is something else again, as Homer C. Truscott could easily prove to you. Homer C. Truscott is a coal dealer and carries coal to Lewiston and vicinity direct from the mines. Now, to carry the coal, he has a fleet of seven trucks, and to power his seven trucks, he must have gasoline. That's elementary. But picking the right gasoline to power his trucks is far from elementary. It's a job that calls for testing one gasoline against another and selecting from many brands the one brand that gives the most miles for the least cost. In other words, you've got to find the gasoline that will pay you a profit. Homer C. Truscott has picked Richfield high-octane gasoline as the gasoline that pays him a profit in long mileage and surging power. For his money, Richfield high-octane is the champion of all regular-priced gasolines. Now, when gasoline-buying experts like Homer Truscott choose Richfield high-octane gasoline over every other brand, there must be something to it. So wouldn't it be a good idea to try this famous Richfield high-octane in your car? Try a tankful the next time you need gasoline. Ride with a champion and keep your motor young. The murders of two young girls in nearby towns in Massachusetts last week promised strong repercussions in several state legislatures next year, not only in the East, but also in the South and the West. Some of the welfare and law enforcement associations keep a very close finger on the pulse of opinion in many states, and they report that the Massachusetts murders may well become a cause célèbre in the annals of American penology and court procedure. The aspect of the cases that is causing the most attention is the fact that a 16-year-old high school boy held in one of the murders had a record of two previous arrests for attempted criminal assault. In the first case, the boy received a suspended sentence. In the second, he was at liberty under bail. Now, deplorable as the circumstances seem, the case looks on the surface like a strictly local matter, a case in which people of other states can have nothing but academic interest. But quite another story is told about this aspect in New York. It's declared that the case will be the springboard for a nationwide movement to put a stop to what realists call wishful experimentation in penology and granting paroles. The realists and conservatives will make their hardest fight for laws to prevent continuation of parole, bail, or suspended sentences after the offender is accused the second time. They claim that parole officers, judges, and social workers connected with the courts continually grant freedom to a youth who is entangled a second time with the law after being paroled once. This is done, according to the critical lawyers and police officials, both because of false humanitarianism and because of the stubborn refusal of those involved to admit that they have made a mistake. Just plain stubborn professional pride. The whole parole system has been under attack for several years now in a number of legislatures because of this so-called do-gooder attitude, and the Massachusetts cases apparently are just what the opponents of leniency toward young offenders have been looking for in the way of ammunition. Now that Dr. Chaim Weizmann has returned to England by plane, it can be revealed that he's perfecting a new high explosive to help Britain win the war against Hitler. Dr. Weizmann is best known to the world for his activities in behalf of the Zionist cause. He's president of the Jewish Agency for Palestine and the World Zionist Organization. However, Dr. Weizmann is equally famous in the world of science as a biochemist. During the World War, Dr. Weizmann was an obscure chemistry professor at the University of Manchester. Germany's submarine blockade had cut off England's access to acetone, necessary to the manufacture of TNT. Prime Minister Lloyd George called in Dr. Weizmann and put him in charge of the Chemical Warfare Department. He was told that he had only a limited amount of time in which to discover a new source of supply of acetone. He set to work, and far sooner than anyone had expected, he discovered a new source of which there was an abundant supply in England. He succeeded in extracting acetone from, of all things, chestnuts. For this achievement, the British government was prepared to pay Dr. Weizmann homage and shower him with honors. The great Jewish scientist declined all honors with the statement that he wished for only one thing, that the British government aid the Jews in establishing a Jewish national home in Palestine. Today, Britain is going through another critical period, and Dr. Weizmann is busy again. Confidentially, we can tell you that since the outbreak of the war, he's been directing chemical research in his laboratories in England, as well as in his Chemical Research Institute in Palestine. Among other things, Dr. Weizmann has discovered a process for extracting acetone from oranges, the main crop in Palestine. One of the reasons for Dr. Weizmann's visit to America was to study the chemical side of the defense industry in this country. The last 5 weeks of his visit were spent in California, center of America's orange production. Tonight, Dr. Weizmann is back in England, ready to communicate the results of his work to the British government. And soon, we are told, Britain will have a new explosive which will far exceed in power anything previously seen on the face of the earth. Before signing off, we'll have an inside story about legislation to permit draftees to be sent outside the Western Hemisphere. Meanwhile, once upon a time, fishermen had to throw in a line to find out if the fish were biting. But those trial and error days are gone forever. The Richfield Fisherman's Calendar, you see, tells you how the fish will bite on any given day throughout the year. Its predictions are based on the moon, the tides, and other factors which influence fishing. Now, the calendar is absolutely free. Just ask for one at your Richfield dealers. And ask your Richfield dealer, too, for a Richfield Fisherman's Roadmap of the state in which you're planning a fishing trip. This map will show you popular fishing spots, tell you catch limits, and other fishing laws. Now, here's a suggestion for every motorist. To conserve gasoline for national defense, keep your spark plugs clean and properly spaced. Just one dirty or faulty plug may waste 1 gallon of gasoline in 10. Now, there'll be other gasoline-saving suggestions on future Confidential Yours programs. Try them to make every gallon of gasoline do extra duty. And try the gasoline selected for extra duty by thousands of transportation experts. Richfield high-octane gasoline. Ride with a chap in and keep your motor young. When Acting Secretary of State Sumner Wells cracked down verbally on Japan today, a number of military and naval men in Washington nodded their heads knowingly. They made it clear, albeit confidentially, that if President Roosevelt and the State Department want a showdown with Japan, the President has the power to achieve it without waiting for congressional action. Although the President and Chief of Staff General Marshall, for the sake of unity, are trying to win the consent of Congress to remove its ban on the use of drafted soldiers abroad, actually, they say, the President has the power to send any part of the Army, Navy, or Marine Corps, including the draftees and the National Guard, anywhere he thinks necessary, even in the face of a direct prohibition of such action by Congress. These officers contend that Congress exceeded its constitutional authority by writing into the draft law a ban on service outside the Western Hemisphere. They contend that the Constitution gives the President the clear power to send any part of the armed forces anywhere in the world, and that the only real control Congress has is over the purse strings of the military establishment. No mere law can amend the Constitution. In other words, while the President probably wishes to act by and with the consent of Congress, they say he doesn't have to have that consent. He can send warships, Marines, and even units of the Army containing drafted men and National Guardsmen to the farthest reaches of the Pacific. Congress would then be faced with a choice of either supporting the President or refusing to appropriate money for American armed forces that were already in the field. Congress could also move to impeach the President. But this particular group of military men insist the impeachment would fail, for they are sure that the constitutional legality is on the side of the President. And that's Confidentially Yours, Arthur Hale. The material for Confidentially Yours is gathered and prepared by Transradio. The next program will be tomorrow night at 7:15. Keep them flying.
This is the Mutual Broadcasting System. Today, the Ad Club of Los Angeles welcomes home its veterans of World War II. Station KFI joins in saluting these veterans whose services, whose sacrifices, and whose achievements we can never forget. In the next few minutes, we would like to recall some events of the past few years, recall through transcriptions made at the time. Remember December 8, 1941? President Roosevelt spoke to the combined houses of Congress and to every man and woman in America.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense, but always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
Another event those within the draft age will never forget. The scene was the Departmental Auditorium in Washington. On the stage was a large fishbowl containing 9,000 capsules, which would be taken out one at a time to determine the order of the draft. Every young man in America and most young women were listening as Carlton Smith described the scene.
The president coming now from the back of the stage with his secretary and military aide, Brigadier General Edwin M. Watson. And here he comes into view of the people which have thronged and filled the Departmental Auditorium to overflowing this morning in order that they may hear his address. He will be introduced to this audience by Dr. Clarence A. Dykstra, Director of the Selective Service System. And now we present Dr. Dykstra.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
The President spoke to the men of America and their families. Then,
Secretary of War will now draw the first number.
There's the announcement by the President of the fact that Secretary of War would draw the first number. They're standing there visiting now. The officers are removing the paper covering from the large glass bowl, which contains the 9,000 blue, opaque blue capsules. A small paper blindfold is now being placed over the eyes of the Secretary of War. In the background, you hear the clicking of the cameras as they all record for their newspapers this most important event in the history of our country. And now the Secretary of War reaches in. He's asked to hold it for a moment, but he has in his fingers one of the small blue capsules which have been shaken and shaken and shaken so that no one can possibly know anything about the order in which they're placed in the bowl. He pauses for a moment, still blindfolded, being watched by the President, and holds in his fingers the blue capsule, which he has now withdrawn from the jar. In just a moment, it will. Now the blindfold has been removed. The Secretary is opening the capsule, and it is our information that he himself will announce that first number. We can. Yes, he's coming toward the microphone, and we expect to hear in just a moment. Let's listen.
The first number drawn by the Secretary of War is serial number 158.
The gasp was from a mother whose son had number 158. A scene none of us will ever forget. Remember the year 1944?
...1944 was the year of decision in Europe. General Dwight D. Eisenhower, Supreme Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force, arrived in England on January 16th. The preparations for the invasion of the continent had reached the operational stage. In Italy, the Allied armies, deadlocked in the mountains below Cassino, leapfrogged forward to Anzio, 30 miles from Rome. For 17 bitter weeks, they battered their way to the city's gates. On June 5th came the news of the fall of Rome, and the president spoke to the nation, warning that victory still lay some distance ahead. At that very hour and all night, the English Channel swarmed with ships, 4,000 of them escorted by 11,000 planes. In 24 hours, 250,000 men stormed the Normandy beaches against the murderous fire of the enemy.
All day, the nation's millions, breathless with hope and fear, sat waiting and praying with beating hearts. That night, the president's voice was heard in millions of American homes.
My fellow Americans, last night, when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far.
Remember how in the darkest hours of the war, there was one voice from overseas that always gave us hope, even when it offered only blood, sweat, and tears.
Therefore, tonight, I give you a message of good cheer. You deserve it, and the facts endorse it. But be it good cheer or be it bad cheer, will make no difference to us. We shall drive on to the end and do our duty, win or die. God helping us, we can do no other.
Those are men and times we can never forget. Here are men we can't forget either, much as we try. We recall only three, starting with
Adolf Hitler.
Probably the most hated man of his time. Most of the evidence indicates that Hitler is dead now. But dead or alive, history can never forget nor forgive you, Adolf Hitler.
Paul Joseph
Goebbels. Ich habe ein großes Werk gewesen, welche die ganze Welt der Welt hat.
You, too, are beyond justice, Paul Joseph Goebbels. You were a contemptible little figure as a man, but you were dangerous with your lies and your libels and your propaganda. It is indeed ironic that so puny a figure as yourself should have had so much to do with the building of the Superman myth, Dr. Paul Joseph Goebbels.
Heinrich Himmler.
Das wird mich da vor einen schönen Klang, wenn es ihn hier.
Ah, Himmler, the devil will welcome you, for you are of his kind.
Now, happier memories. The week of August 12, 1945. It was a week marked by tremendous developments.
The atomic bomb hit Hiroshima.
Russia entered the war against the Japs.
And Japan gave up the fight. But it wasn't until September 2nd aboard the mighty battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay that the actual surrender ceremony took place. Facing the representatives of the defeated Japanese and with Allied delegations looking on, General MacArthur said,
"It is my earnest hope, and indeed the hope of all mankind, that from this solemn occasion, a better world shall emerge out of the blood and carnage of the past. A world founded upon faith and understanding. A world dedicated to the dignity of man and the fulfillment of his most cherished wish for freedom, tolerance, and justice."
With the end of the war, however, the President of the United States warned us that the struggle for freedom, for peace throughout the world was not over. He said,
"This is a time for great rejoicing and a time for solemn contemplation. With the destructive force of war removed from the world, we can turn now to the grave task of preserving a peace which you gallant men and women have won. It is a task which requires our most urgent attention. It is one in which we must collaborate with our allies and the other nations of the world. They are as determined as we are that war must be abolished from the earth, if the earth as we know it is to remain. Civilization cannot survive another total war.
We have presented a few memories of World War II. Men and women, times and events, hopes and sorrows. Things we can never forget. Nor can we forget the men and women who made ultimate victory possible. That is why we today join in honoring these veterans, members and guests of the Ad Club of Los Angeles. We salute you.
Columbia Broadcasting System presents This Life is Mine, the story of people who seek each day to know themselves. For in today, already walks tomorrow. Eden now felt sure it could no longer be put off. The weeks of doubt and indecision belonged to the past. She knew her mind at last. She wanted to marry Bob Hastings. Meanwhile, she was still engaged to Paul Warner. Waiting until the war was over to tell a fiancé that their engagement must be terminated seemed dishonest and weak. Yet putting all this in a letter to a man overseas with no way of knowing his reaction cut Eden Channing as deeply as it would hurt Paul reading it in far-off England. Yet she must write the letter.
Paul, I wanted to wait until you were back. It'd be easier telling this looking at you. Maybe I'm foolish to think it would be easier under any circumstances. We'll share the deepest kind of pain whether I write these words now or save them to tell you later. I mean, I can't save them. It wouldn't be decent. Last week, Paul, I took off your engagement ring. I couldn't wear it because I knew beyond a doubt that someone else had come to mean a great deal. Even then, I was unwilling to write. I felt that I could make no choice between the two of you. But now I can, and so I must tell you. Will it sound insincere if I say that it isn't that I love you less, but that I love someone else more? Now, I don't quite know why that should be. I fought it. I didn't want it to happen, believe me, dear. I feel ashamed and miserably unhappy when I think of you. Yet I've done nothing for which I should feel shame. You know, there's no rationalizing the magnetic forces that draw two people together. You've told me many times before you left that I'd changed since my father returned to the family. I fought this earlier change, too. I wanted everything to remain exactly as it was when you were here in Freetown. What hurts most of all is having to write you this, because I... Oh. Hello?
Hello, Eden. This is Mary Sprague.
Oh, hello, Miss Sprague. How are you?
Quite well, thank you, dear. I wanted to come over and see you tonight, but I've got a touch of neuritis in my shoulder, and I rather dread going out of doors in this cold. Would it be an imposition if I asked you to come see me?
This evening?
Yes, tonight. It's rather important.
Oh, I'll come then. I'll be over in about an hour. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Eden supposed Miss Sprague wanted to see her in connection with some school matter, Miss Sprague was head of the English department at Freetown High. Meanwhile, Eden continued her letter to Paul in England.
But, Paul, there'd be no living with myself if I deceived you out of weakness or the fear that you'd hate me. Is it entirely wishful thinking on my part? Or have I sent something in your letters, Paul, which make me hope that this news will not come as a complete shock? I'm in such a jumble of thoughts and emotions. There's much more I want you to know, but I can't seem to sort everything out tonight. I'm not really happy, and I guess I never will be until I know that this no longer affects you. If you find it difficult to believe now, maybe you won't one day when you've begun to forgive me. You'll have my affection and my respect always. Eden.
The letter was read and reread many times. Eden's mouth was bitter with grief. The happy hours she and Bob had shared tore at her conscience. In one way, it seemed cruel and selfish to send that letter to Paul, and yet it was the right thing. Ultimately, the only thing to do. As Eden walked to Miss Sprague's home, the sharp February wind whipped about her, chilling her to the bone.
Eden, come in. Oh, you look half frozen. You didn't walk over.
It didn't seem quite so cold when I started out.
I'll put a chair for you right beside the radiator.
Phew! Oh, I'd better drop to zero tonight. What are you doing for your neuritis, Miss Sprague?
Just keeping the heat pad on. I hear your house is rented, Eden.
Uh-huh, we'll be moving out in 10 days. Oh, I see you've new draperies. They're awfully pretty.
I was afraid with all that yellow they might be too gay.
Chintz is supposed to be gay.
Well, I suppose you were surprised when I called and asked you to visit me.
Rather. Generally, when teachers have something to say to each other, they wait until they meet the next day at school.
Oh, now, don't miss the rule. But, you know, I find I'm just as busy after four these days.
Paddy showed a great deal of wisdom when he made you assistant principal. When he retires after the war, Miss Sprague, you should be the principal.
The Board of Education, Mr. Rankin in particular, considers the male species superior to the female. And assistant is as far as I'll get in all likelihood. Eden?
Yes?
Do you think there'd be too much chintz in the room if I covered that wing chair with it?
Well, maybe. There's a pattern in the rug.
Have any of the other teachers phoned you?
Other teachers? No. Nobody except you. Why?
Really? Well, Mr. Cadwallader, Mr. Giles, and Miss Mitchell mentioned they'd be calling.
Miss Sprague had taught my mother English years before. She was one of the most capable and beloved teachers at Freetown High. Her fluttery, restless behavior now astounded me. And then suddenly I realized her purpose in asking me here. She had some painful news to break and didn't quite know how to go about it. I fought a sinking sensation at the pit of my stomach.
I was remarking to Miss Warner today, so many of your family are in New York now.
Yes.
I suppose your father would prefer to have you in New York.
Yes, Father would. As a matter of fact, Jeff will probably be going there at the end of the term to stay.
Then that would leave you here quite alone.
Oh, I'd never be alone in Freetown. I've too many friends.
Eden, would you feel unhappy if you had to leave here?
At one time, I would have shuddered at the idea. But today, I seem to have developed a different attitude toward a lot of things.
Were you surprised when I walked into your last class, Eden?
No, it was about time the head of the English department came in to observe my teaching.
You've improved immeasurably.
I have.
You have greater self-confidence. Comes with teaching experience, naturally. Your manner's more mature, my dear, but for some queer reason, it made you seem younger.
Isn't that quite a contradiction, Miss Sprague?
No. You've grown much more spontaneous, Eden.
Oh.
That's most desirable in a teacher. It's stimulating to her classes.
I think my teaching is improving.
No question of it. Do you ever think about your dramatic talent?
What? No.
Aren't you ever going to find out if you'd enjoy being on the stage?
Miss Sprague, are you advising me to give it a try?
Oh, my dear, I'd never make a good strategist. You know perfectly well I have some unpleasant news to tell you.
Mm-hmm. It has to do with the high school.
It's an embarrassing and unjust situation, and I can see no solution. But I think it's ridiculous to let it continue without telling you what's happening behind the scenes.
You mean what happened at the teachers' meeting to which I wasn't invited?
Neither was Dr. Paddington. A group of us protested the calling of that meeting, but we were very much in the minority.
I see.
You know, a fairly large number of teachers have felt all along that the investigation of the Talmadge shooting is subjecting the entire school to unnecessary criticism and adverse publicity. At the meeting, several spoke out against, well, of all things, your age.
My age?
They feel you're too young to be a high school teacher.
But isn't that silly?
Yes, it is. They raised the untenable point that better discipline is enforced by someone 10 years older. That a teacher at 23 is only 5 or 6 years older than her senior and junior students.
I gather that the general idea is that everyone would be relieved if I resigned.
Mr. Cadwallader, Mr. Giles and I were approached by Mr. Rankin and told that the school board would recommend your suspension.
Oh, no.
They were certain Dr. Paddington would veto it. Of course, this is the very opportunity Mr. Rankin wants to force Dr. Paddington out of Freetown High. And neither you nor I want that to happen.
No, no, of course not.
Well, that's the situation now, and I want you to know it. I believe you're capable of making a wise and mature decision. Of course, nothing of this must reach Dr. Paddington's ears.
No, I know that. He mustn't hear.
Eden was angry and hurt. It was not she who was being attacked, but the beloved high school principal. That was why Howard Rankin had approached the teachers. He hoped for a split in the ranks so that the school board could get control. Eden was furious enough after leaving Miss Spriggs to go directly to the office of the Freetown Journal, where she knew Rankin would be.
I'm sorry I didn't phone for an appointment, Mr. Rankin.
Oh, I thought after the school board meeting yesterday you were through talking to me, Miss Channing.
Not quite.
Will you be quick and tell me what I've done that hasn't got your approval? I can give you 5 minutes.
1 minute will be just about enough. Mr. Rankin, you won't succeed with your vicious scheme to oust Dr. Paddington from Freetown High.
Oh, that's a nice, respectful way for a teacher to talk to the chairman of the school board.
It's about time somebody told you openly that a man who resorts to your methods has no right being on the school board.
And I suppose you'll see to it that I'm removed.
I propose to see to it that Dr. Paddington is not removed.
Well, that's a cock and bull notion that you've cooked up all on your own, Miss Channing. Who wants to remove him?
You do, by suspending me. You're counting on Paddy to veto it. Then you and he can battle it out to a finish. Paddy's finish.
No comment, Miss Channing.
The board will suspend me
Harry Allbright says he's rented your house and you're moving in with the Paddingtons. That's all?
Yes. Oh, I see the point you're trying to make. Dr. Paddy will be even more prejudiced in my favor since my brother and I'll be living at his house.
Makes a piece of gossip for the social page. Well, I've got a paper to set up for tomorrow.
Mr. Rankin, I'm resigning before the board suspends me.
Oh, wait a minute. Better not be in too big a hurry. A teacher needs credentials to get a job. Resign and you'll never teach in Freetown again.
This sudden interest in my welfare is very touching. I see you understand very clearly that my resignation destroys your little scheme to get rid of Dr. Paddington.
This move to save Paddington is very noble and touching. But what will you do afterwards?
That, Mr. Rankin, is my concern, not yours. Good night.
Walking home in the cold, Eden was too stunned to think. She would make good her intention, of course. But she didn't yet see that her resignation would leave nothing to hold her in Freetown. ¶¶ Life is Mine stars Betty Winkler in the role of Eden Channing and is written by Addie Richton and Lynn Stone. Your announcer is Tony Morvan. This Life is Mine is directed by Mark Sloan. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.